You are listening to part two of the chapter Frontal Lobe of the Brain from the book Depression the Way Out by Dr. Neil Nedley. How can I improve frontal lobe health? So far, we've seen that a healthy frontal lobe is vital in the prevention of mental disorders as well as in the pursuit of a satisfactory quality of life. This begs the question, how can I protect and enhance the health of my frontal lobe? The remainder of the chapter is devoted to the answer to this question. We will examine two approaches. The first one considers therapies that require the services of a treating practitioner. Second, we will examine therapies that can be performed by the patient himself. These therapies include actions to take and actions to avoid. Therapies initiated by practitioners to optimize frontal lobe function. Medical doctors and other healthcare practitioners have for centuries treated depression. The growing awareness of the frontal lobe's role in depression has been used to explain or justify the success of existing therapies, which mostly have centered around drug medicines. I deal at length with current antidepressant medications in Chapter 6. A lengthy repeat is not needed here. However, I will reiterate some of the most important details. Our understanding of the frontal lobe has helped to explain why many of the newer antidepressants are effective. Serotonin therapy, boost the levels. Drugs that boost brain serotonin levels appear to be treating an underlying problem in the vital prefrontal cortex. Autopsy studies of more than 200 individuals were conducted by researchers at the New York State Psychiatric Institute and Columbia University. They discovered that patients with a history of major depression had a reduced ability for the brain to utilize serotonin compared to individuals who never experienced a major depression. Among the depressed individuals, those who committed suicide had an even more reduced ability to utilize serotonin. The reduced utilization of serotonin is the result of serotonin-binding changes in the brain. This finding is in harmony with earlier work of this same research group. Previously, they had published data on serotonin-binding changes in the ventral prefrontal cortex in correlation with suicide. These reports have provided further evidence for a connection between this localized portion of the frontal lobe and both impulsive aggression and suicide. Many practitioners have used evidence like this to encourage further use of drugs or other interventions that boost serotonin levels. Serotonin levels can be increased with drugs and with diet. Chapter 6 has information on the drug approach, and Chapter 4 deals with the dietary approach. Chapter 5 shows how sunlight and exercise can also increase serotonin levels. Later in this chapter, we will discuss diet and serotonin. Shock treatments. Another therapy that's been bolstered and refined from our understanding of the key role of the frontal lobe is shock therapy, more commonly referred to as shock treatments. For years, severely depressed people have been given shock therapy as the treatment of last resort after antidepressant drugs and psychological counseling had failed. In shock therapy, electrodes are placed on the scalp. Electric pulses strong enough to trigger a grand mal type seizure are sent through the electrodes. To prevent pain and physical injury from convulsions during the therapy, the patient is given general anesthesia. The treatments are usually given 2 or 3 times a week for several weeks. About 90% of the time, the treatment works well, better, in fact, than drugs that only help in 60 to 70% of cases. Evidence indicates that shock treatments work because it changes brain function in the critical prefrontal cortex region. Because of its effectiveness, estimates suggest that some 65,000 U.S. patients per year receive shock treatments. With an average of 8 treatments per course yielding at least 500,000 treatments per year, the annual cost is approximately $200 million. Besides its hefty price tag, it has other serious downsides, including confusion and memory problems. The memory problems include difficulty storing new memories and loss of previous memories. The latter is usually the most problematic in the long term. It tends to affect memories of happenings that occurred close to the time of the shock sessions. However, the amnesia can extend back several months or even years. Although improvement can occur, recovery is typically incomplete, with irreversible amnesia persisting for some events. Many patients may find little consolation in research documenting that personal memory, memory about themselves, tends to be less affected than the so-called impersonal memory, knowledge about the world and other events that they didn't experience personally. Although quite rare, death can result from shock treatments, usually due to heart stoppage. Furthermore, the beneficial effects of elevating the mood of the patient may last as little as 3 to 6 months. Memory problems from shock treatments should not be shrugged off. The association is even more troubling because depression itself, even without shock treatments, can undermine memory. Magnet therapy. There are other emerging therapies for depression that have developed as a result of the growing understanding of the frontal lobe's importance. One of the most promising of these therapies is magnet therapy. Through this technique, brain researchers have discovered another way to jolt the brain out of depression without the harmful effects of shock treatment. Although magnet therapy is not as potent, it does appear to have far fewer side effects. It is not an electric current, but a magnetic field that passes through the skull into the brain. Magnetic therapy relies on an age-old physics principle of the electromagnet. If an electric current is passed through a coil of wires, a magnetic field is generated perpendicular to the flow of the electricity through the coil. Furthermore, that generated magnetic field acts on a conductive medium, something that can, in turn, conduct electricity. An electric current will be generated in the medium, in a parallel but opposite direction as the current in the coil. The generator on your car uses this principle. Magnetic therapy is performed by placing the coil of wire over a selected portion of the scalp, such as the frontal lobe. Current is then intermittently pulsed through the coil, creating a strong on and off magnetic field. This magnetic field in turn creates a current in the brain. This current is strong enough to actually stimulate nerve cells, causing them to fire, or, in technical terms, depolarize. Interestingly, nerve cell depolarization is based on the very same principle as shock therapy. Magnet therapy in the left and right frontal lobe. Although this therapy is relatively new, results are encouraging for relieving depression. The target for relieving depression with magnet therapy is the frontal lobe. Depression is characterized not only by generalized frontal lobe impairment, but also by deficiencies in particular areas of the frontal lobe. Emerging research takes these concepts one step further and suggests that there is also a functioning imbalance between the right and the left frontal lobes. Major depression and the negative symptoms associated with it is caused and/or perpetuated by decreased left frontal lobe function and blood flow with respect to the right. Because magnetic therapy can be used to stimulate or depress very specific areas of the brain, this treatment has added further support to these theories. How can magnet therapy in one case stimulate and in another situation depress the brain? It appears that fast-frequency repetitive magnet therapy excites the brain area being treated, while slow-frequency repetition inhibits or tones down brain activity. By applying this knowledge, researchers have demonstrated that they can help treat depression by using either the treatments that stimulate the left frontal lobe or treatments that decrease activity in the right frontal lobe. The effect of these two divergent therapies lends a significant measure of support to the theory that part of the problem in depression is due to greater impairment in the left frontal lobe function compared to the right. Dr. Mark George recently provided further confirmation of these relationships in a 1999 review of magnet therapy that he co-authored. Dr. George revealed that in earlier unpublished work, his group had found that when depressed patients received the fast-frequency version expected to stimulate the right frontal lobe, their depression worsened. In this regard, magnet therapy, which can target a specific region, may actually be more beneficial than drug therapy, which has generalized effects on the entire brain, or even shock therapy, which also cannot be precisely targeted. Some preliminary research suggests that magnetic therapy may be as good or better than any of the conventional therapies delivered by practitioners. However, it is really too soon to bestow the garland of champion of depression therapies on magnetic therapy. There is more to be learned about this kind of therapy. Shock therapy versus magnetic therapy. Which is better? Shock therapy still appears to obtain superior effects in those with severe psychotic depression, a state in which the patient loses touch with reality. In spite of questions about its success, magnetic therapy still appears to fill a unique role. Because it can stimulate specific brain regions, it offers promise as an addition to drug medication. Another plus for magnetic therapy, it has been demonstrated to enhance the effectiveness of serotonin-boosting medications. From the standpoint of side effects, magnetic therapy has demonstrated that nerve cell firing can be induced without the extreme measures employed by shock treatments. Magnetic therapy does not require anesthesia. Shock treatments cause painful stimulation of scalp pain receptors. Magnetic therapy is not particularly painful, although it can cause an occasional mild headache or discomfort at the site of the coil. So far, magnetic therapy's record looks relatively good when it comes to seizures, though it is of concern that a few have occurred. There is evidence that magnetic therapy generally does not cause confusion or memory problems. Other studies have raised some concern about memory impairment. A preliminary report from a study designed to look at mental side effects from magnetic therapy treatments for depression found no evidence of memory problems. Nonetheless, it may have other subtle emotional or hormonal effects. There is conflicting preliminary evidence that stimulatory treatments over the prefrontal cortex may increase short-term feelings of sadness and decrease self-related happiness in normal volunteers. Other research has documented elevations in levels of thyroid-stimulating hormones following magnetic therapy treatments. Electromagnetic radiation and cancer. There is little to ease public concerns about links between electromagnetic radiation and cancer. Conflicting data continues to be published. Recent pooled data showing a doubling of leukemia risk in children with greater exposure to magnetic fields has fueled greater concern in some circles. Unfortunately, we do not have sufficient experience with the extremely strong magnetic fields that are repetitively used in the course of magnetic therapy for treating depression. Thus, the jury is still out. The cancer concern remains another unknown risk with respect to this otherwise encouraging therapy. Like any newer promising treatment, magnetic therapy must prove its safety and efficacy over time. At present, I think magnetic therapy should be seriously considered when discussions gravitate to the alternative of shock therapy. However, I would not be anxious to put a moderately depressed loved one in line for the next available treatment. We really do not know enough about the long-term effects of such brain stimulation. Magnetic therapy has further increased my desire to find ways to target lifestyle therapies for depression. Are there ways that we can help the frontal lobe in general or aid in restoring balance between right and left frontal lobes without using the medications, shock treatments, or magnetic therapy? Fortunately, the answer is a resounding yes. And a host of thrilling lifestyle approaches provides that affirmative answer. We will now leave the realm of therapies that require the services of a treating practitioner. Let us turn our attention to lifestyle therapies that can be performed by the patient himself. We will look at these lifestyle therapies by focusing on two categories. First, we will consider injurious lifestyle factors that should be avoided because they suppress optimal frontal brain performance. Next, we will discover desirable lifestyle factors that should be adopted because they enhance the functioning of this key brain region. There are a number of lifestyle factors that suppress frontal lobe function. The use of several drugs will damage the frontal lobe. Let's look at the effect that each of these drugs has on the frontal lobe. We will begin with street drugs. Street drugs impair the frontal lobe. Many Americans are highly concerned about our nation's heavy and increasing use of drugs. There has been a sharp upturn recently in both the acceptance of illicit drugs and the use of those drugs among the American youth, according to widely publicized surveys. Parents are fearful that their children will use illicit drugs, become addicted, and suffer all the physical, mental, and social effects of addiction. They also fear that their children might engage in high-risk behaviors that could ultimately cut short their young lives. This last concern is especially important. A person who has ingested a drug can have blunted frontal lobe function, though his appearance may not show it. Such impairment leads to risk-taking behavior that can result in an automobile accident, contracting HIV infection, or some other life-changing, life-ending event. Drugs other than illicit drugs can also impair frontal lobe function. Many feel cheated if they pay to see a doctor and do not walk away with at least one prescription for a medicinal drug. Television, radio, and magazine ads bombard us with our need for over-the-counter prescription remedies. Caffeine and alcohol are culturally accepted drugs. Nicotine use is socially stigmatized, but it is still treated legally as a lifestyle choice and not the powerfully addictive, mind-altering drug that it really is. Nonetheless, these agents take a toll on frontal brain function. Illicit drugs and mental impairment. The danger of illicit drugs on mental performance are well documented. There seems to be little need to belabor how much mind-altering drugs transform the mind, including the frontal lobe. This problem is worse than previously thought. There's growing evidence that drugs of abuse affect the brain long after their short-term effects have worn off. Recent studies funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse found that college students who were regular marijuana users had defects in their attention, memory, and learning as long as 24 hours after their last use of the drug. Long after the high was over, the brain was still struggling along in low gear. Marijuana, like its cousin alcohol and nicotine, has now been shown to harm the brain of the developing fetus. A mother who uses marijuana gives her child a lifelong legacy of brain impairment. For optimal frontal lobe function, leave illicit drugs out of the picture. Alcohol injures the frontal lobe. Alcohol directly affects the frontal lobe in addition to worsening the risk of medication side effects. In fact, it is one of America's most popular frontal lobe assailants. Let's examine some of the illuminating research. Several years ago, alcoholics and non-alcoholics were studied by MRI and PET scans. Among the alcoholics, the MRI revealed a striking amount of loss of frontal lobe gray matter, where the brain's nerve cells are concentrated. This is in contrast to the deeper line white matter, where the nerve fibers leaving those cells predominate. This loss of gray matter indicates an actual loss of brain cells that are involved in critical frontal lobe functions. PET scanning showed corresponding changes in brain function. The alcoholics showed a lower glucose metabolism, indicative of less frontal lobe activity. These frontal lobe impairing effects are not confined to heavy alcohol users. Researchers found a measurable decrease in abstract thinking ability among 1,300 men and women who were social drinkers. These individuals drank as little as one alcoholic beverage per week. The men in the study had about 2 drinking occasions per week and consumed 2 to 3 alcoholic drinks on those occasions. The women drank even less. On the average, they only drank every 5th day and consumed 2 alcoholic drinks. Even with these low levels of use, assessments of mental functioning showed impairment. In fact, as alcohol intake increased, their ability to think abstractly, a measure of frontal lobe performance, decreased even more. Acute alcohol effects or intoxication could not explain these changes, since all assessments of mental function were done at least 24 hours after the last consumption of alcohol. Many people believe that automobile accidents are more frequent among drinkers primarily because of the profound effect on coordination, judgment, and alertness seen in drunks and others who are manifestly intoxicated. However, in many cases, the problem may actually relate to more subtle deficiencies in judgment that occur in seemingly unimpaired social drinkers. Such alcohol-using drivers may have no impairment in coordination. Their speech may appear normal. However, a few moments later, they may find themselves skidding off the highway or involved in a collision. The reason? Impaired judgment failed to provide adequate warning about necessary speed reductions to successfully negotiate a curve or stop in time to prevent an impending roadway emergency. Individuals with a blood alcohol concentration of 0.05 to 0.09%, less than the legal limit in many states, have at least 9 times the risk of a fatal traffic accident than if their blood alcohol concentration were 0. This is largely due to the fact that alcohol impairs the frontal lobe long before it impairs other parts of the brain, such as the coordination center. Caffeine unbalances the mind. Caffeine has far-reaching effects on the brain. At least one of those effects comes as no surprise. After all, it is America's preferred stimulant. However, a heavy price is paid for that stimulation. Let us see how caffeine works and then explore some of its associated side effects. Caffeine impinges on the brain's communication system in a number of ways. In exploring these relationships, we need to recall that the brain cells talk to one another through chemical interchanges. Nerve cells release chemicals called chemical messengers, or neurotransmitters, that are picked up by neighboring cells. These messengers then cause changes to occur in the cell that receives them. Some messengers cause stimulation of the recipient nerve cell, and others cause depression. Caffeine's widespread influence focuses primarily on its ability to affect the levels of 2 chemical messengers called acetylcholine and adenosine. Caffeine disrupts the brain's chemistry by increasing the levels of acetylcholine and interferes with the transmission of adenosine. Thus, caffeine upsets the delicate balance of nerve transmission in the brain, which may have devastating consequences. Adenosine tones down, or puts the brakes on, many aspects of brain nerve transmission, but caffeine weakens its power to do its work, thus allowing artificial stimulation of the brain from the caffeine. At first, adenosine may seem like the bad guy. After all, who wants to depress their brain transmission? Perhaps we can see this issue more clearly by looking at an analogy. the importance of good brakes on an automobile. You do not get into your automobile to stop. You get in it to go somewhere. However, you wouldn't feel comfortable driving a car that didn't have the capacity to stop. Good brakes are essential, especially on a vehicle designed to go. Similarly, chemical messengers like adenosine that have a large role in putting the brakes on are very important for balance in the brain. There are serious concerns in the psychiatric literature about caffeine's role in unbalancing the mind. Caffeine has been linked to anxiety, anxiety neurosis, psychosis, a state where the person loses touch with reality, and schizophrenia, the so-called split personality disorder. Other researchers add to this list caffeine-induced delirium and anorexia nervosa, an aversion to food. A chemical messenger called dopamine also rises when you drink caffeinated beverages. This action is worrisome. Some of the most profound psychiatric diseases, such as schizophrenia, appear to be due, in part, to excess amounts of dopamine. In fact, standard drug therapy for these serious mental disorders involves the use of dopamine-blocking agents. Consequently, it is not surprising that caffeine, an agent that raises dopamine levels, increases the risk of certain mental illnesses, even though it may appear harmless on the surface. Other psychiatric diseases with profound frontal lobe effects may result from the unbalancing of brain metabolism by caffeine. This is particularly true of depression. As we have already seen, decreased frontal lobe function and blood flow appear to be a characteristic of depression. Research indicates that caffeine can contribute to these deleterious findings. Researchers have known for years that caffeine can significantly decrease frontal lobe blood flow. Caffeine has been documented to decrease whole brain blood flow by as much as 30%. All this evidence on impaired brain blood flow naturally raises a question. Is there any documented connection between caffeine use and depression? The internationally acclaimed Norwegian research project, known as the Tromsø Heart Study, has provided a partial answer. The Scandinavian researchers assessed 143,000 men and women and found a significant increase in depression among women who were heavy coffee users, but not in men who used similar amounts of coffee. In addition to the link with depression, women who used more coffee also had more problems coping with stress. The reason that these effects did not show up in the men is not clear. It may indicate that women are more susceptible to caffeine, or it may reflect caffeine's exploitation of a greater female disposition to depression. The link between impaired frontal lobe blood flow and depression, when coupled with caffeine's effect in robbing the brain's blood flow, simply cannot be ignored. When the Tromsø Heart Study evidence is added to the puzzle, I think the verdict is clear. If you are seeking to treat or avoid depression, caffeine should be eliminated from your program. The brain's adjustment to caffeine creates dependency. If caffeine is so good for us as some people, even some scientists, would like us to believe, it is interesting to note that the brain puts forth great effort to undo the effects of this popular legal drug. When exposed to caffeine on a daily basis, the brain tries to compensate in at least two ways. First, it decreases its production of acetylcholine. This appears to be a way to lessen the impact of the increased acetylcholine levels brought on by caffeine. Second, the brain increases its number of adenosine receptors. This is likely a response to give adenosine more of an effect in brain communication, in spite of the fact that caffeine is blocking its function to some extent. Unfortunately, these brain changes contribute to caffeine dependency. Brain structure and function become changed, and consequently, the brain actually comes to expect caffeine's effects on its neurons. This is one of the reasons coffee users are so committed to their morning brew. If they don't get their caffeine, they feel like they're running at less than half throttle. If coffee users stop using their Java, they are likely to develop withdrawal symptoms, such as headache in addition to fatigue. Caffeine withdrawal and headaches. Many wonder why headaches occur during caffeine withdrawal. The answer probably resides in either adenosine, acetylcholine, or both these transmitters. One of the important functions in adenosine that is blocked in part by caffeine is relaxation or dilation of the blood vessels, particularly those of the heart and brain. With habitual caffeine consumption, the brain increases the number of adenosine receptors in an attempt to offset caffeine's competition. Once caffeine is removed, however, this increased number of receptors is still there for a short time. And now, unopposed action of adenosine causes marked blood vessel relaxation. With relaxed blood vessels to the brain, there's increased blood flow that causes congestion in the brain. Many attribute the caffeine withdrawal headache to this mechanism. Interestingly, the brain's attempt to deal with caffeine-induced acetylcholine changes may also predispose to caffeine withdrawal headaches. The quick remedy for caffeine withdrawal headache is ingesting coffee, caffeinated soda pop, or one of many over-the-counter headache pills that contain caffeine, like Excedrin. None of these options is as good as toughing out the withdrawal. Usually within 2 days, the brain adjusts to a normal internal environment without caffeine. The headaches will be gone, and the brain will be well on its way to a better chemical balance. Unfortunately, I've had a few patients that had severe headaches for up to 2 weeks after caffeine withdrawal. In these cases, there may have been an underlying tendency to headache that was triggered by caffeine withdrawal. In practical terms, caffeine's disruption of brain chemistry sets the stage for more than just caffeine withdrawal problems and the obvious psychiatric illnesses that we have already mentioned. Habitual coffee drinkers can have weakened physical and mental performance even if they have no psychiatric symptoms and are not undergoing withdrawal. According to research, the drug does tend to help people do simple tasks more quickly, but it is disruptive on more complex tasks of motor reaction time and fine motor coordination. The decreased production of acetylcholine that results from regular caffeine use also plays a role. Researchers consistently find that decrease in brain acetylcholine is associated with impaired mental function. Furthermore, despite common lore, the authors of an extensive medical review on caffeine found no evidence that this drug helped to improve intellectual capacity. Some of the effects of caffeine on the brain are that it tends to produce dependence, can cause drug withdrawal reactions, it can worsen psychiatric illnesses, it impairs physical and mental performance, it interferes with sleep, it may influence the risk of other illnesses that in turn exert frontal lobe effects through physical or mental stress, and it may exert effects that impact on spiritual and social dimensions of character. It comes as no surprise that caffeine interferes with sleep. Caffeine consumption within 6 hours of bedtime makes it harder to fall asleep, decreases the total amount of time slept, and significantly worsens sleep quality. Caffeine decreases the deepest, most restorative stages of sleep. More surprising is that extensive amounts of caffeine can cause severe brain problems, including seizures. There are even descriptions of human fatalities due to caffeine. So much for the damages caused by caffeine. Next, we look at the effects of another common drug, nicotine. Nicotine impairs the frontal lobe. Nicotine addiction continues to be a global plague. This pernicious drug has stimulant effects on the nervous system similar to caffeine and should be avoided. Quality of sleep, performance of tasks, and even stress control all suffer while using cigarettes. Smokers are less able to perform complex mental tasks than non-smokers. This is ironic, since many smokers believe mental function is actually improved by smoking. The catch is that when they quit, these problems worsen initially before getting better. So, shortly after some individuals become non-smokers, they mistakenly think that smoking was helping them in these areas, and they return to their cigarettes after a few days of abstinence. In addition to short-term mental effects, smoking takes a long-term toll on brain function. Compared to non-smokers, smokers significantly increase their risk of brain-damaging strokes. Initial reports suggesting that smoking may help decrease the risk of Alzheimer's disease have not stood up to further scrutiny. In short, nicotine is a leading cause of lost mental function, stroke, without providing any long-term benefits for brain health. Nicotine's prenatal effects are also important to emphasize. Nicotine used by a pregnant woman impairs brain function in her child, perhaps for life. Research shows mental deficits in children of smokers that can only be explained by the effects of nicotine. One study made a comparison of mental function between 3-year-old children of women who smoked throughout their entire pregnancy with children of those who quit during pregnancy. Children of those who kicked the habit tested significantly better. Nicotine is linked to depression. Nicotine is clearly linked to depression. epidemiological studies indicate that smokers have an increased risk of depression. Furthermore, the more they smoke, the greater their risk. It is possible that smoking increases depression risk through effects similar to that of caffeine, decreases in cerebral blood flow, even though some depression-related brain messenger chemicals may increase. Older studies indicated that cigarette smoking actually increased cerebral blood flow, but newer research has revealed a much more complicated picture. For example, in research from Japan, Nakamura and colleagues found that after 15 hours of nicotine abstinence, some smokers had increases while others had decreases in brain blood flow. Edward Domino and colleagues at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor added further complexity to the nicotine brain blood flow relationships. They found that nicotine intake in smokers who had been abstinent for 10 hours increased blood flow to some brain areas but decreased blood supply to others. Of concern from the standpoint of depression was a decrease in left-sided brain flow relative to the right in the hippocampal-parahippocampal areas. These areas stimulate the critical orbitomedial prefrontal cortex, and therefore may indicate a nicotine-induced overdominance of the right frontal lobe, changes that could predispose to depression. Still other researchers assert that smoking probably does not increase the risk for depression. They claim that the reason nicotine use keeps company with depression is because individuals with a depressive tendency tend to medicate themselves with nicotine. Nicotine can raise brain levels of mood-elevating chemicals. Although the discussion can go back and forth on this subject, several facts remain. First, researchers agree that there is a connection between smoking and depression. Second, no medical practitioner recommends nicotine as a legitimate depression treatment. Therefore, from both the perspective of depression as well as other nicotine-related brain effects, it is best to leave this addictive chemical out of one's life. You've been listening to Part 2 in the book Depression: The Way Out by Dr. Neil Nedley. Copyright 2014. To purchase this or other books by Dr. Nedley, or to learn more about the 10-day residential programs or 8-week community programs, visit www.nedleyhealthsolutions.com.